This episode of New Politics was released on the 13th of August, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, there are lessons for the Liberal Party from the last election, but what are the lessons for the Labor Party? Nuclear energy rears its ugly head again, and as usual, it's all about the politics. And the Barilaro New York Trade Commissioner job just keeps causing trouble for the New South Wales government. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, and I would have got away with it if it wasn't for you meddling kids.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. There's been a little bit of a lull in federal politics, so that's given us a little bit of breathing space and a chance to reflect on how the new parliament is progressing. And parliament does look a little bit different, and the pace of parliament is different. The Labor government does have a sense of urgency about it. It's introduced bills on climate change, repealing the cashless debit card, reforming aged care, restoring territory rights, paid family and domestic violence leave. It's also released details about the voice to parliament. So the government has been very busy, which is what you'd expect all new governments to do, and that's the way that it should be. But since the election in May, we've been looking at what the messages are for the Liberal Party from that result and its future in politics. But we haven't really looked at what the messages are for the Labor Party. The major parties had record lows in their primary vote at the last election, and there's now the highest level of independence in Parliament. But what should the Labor Party, now that they have formed government, what should they be considering for their prospects at future elections? And I know that they've only been in office for several months, but political parties do need to take into account longer term issues as well.
There's a couple of things on the horizon that may not be electorally so successful. Firstly, I think the Julian Assange issue may burn a lot of credibility with Labor supporters. There's a lot of people who want Assange returned to Australia and all charges dropped. The American government is not keen on this. And there are various treaties and agreements which I suspect tie the Australian government into supporting whatever the US wants with Assange. I said, I think, a couple of podcasts ago that even the normally forthright Penny Wong was much more subdued in her talking about the issue than one might expect. I think, too, the issue with the environment. Certainly getting the 43% through with Green support is a triumph, since it had been at nothing. Now it's nearly halfway there, and we may not be able to get it to 100%, at least in our lifetimes, but we can at least reduce it. There was some resistance within the Labor Party itself to reducing to 43%, which most experts agree isn't quite enough, but are acknowledging is a start. Whether the Labor Party will become intransigent against the Greens' resistance to not cutting any more, or whether a lot of the naysayers in the party will come around. Another issue is the factions. This is one that all parties go through, and it was hugely destructive for the Liberal Party in that dominant factions stop listening to the smaller factions, even when they have good ideas. That type of thing where the small egos of a big reforming government can bring it down. It's partly the management skill of the leader and the deputy and the whips, but there are some people who can't be controlled. They have to control themselves. We saw this in New South Wales Labor. We saw it in federal Labor in the past. We've seen it in all states, really. That lack of discipline. Now, there's no signs of it yet, but it's got to be controlled before it runs out of control, because once that type of stuff is locked in, it's very hard to get out of it.
Oh, well, governments, once they win office, they usually put aside any electoral issues that they might have to think about in the future. And that makes sense. If you've just won government, well, who's got time for internal political reform? But Labor did promise a less combative and more consultative political process if they won the election. And so far, there's been an uneasy kind of truce between Labor and the Australian Greens on the climate change bill. But still, they haven't missed the opportunity to have a go at each other. And this might be more about appealing to their respective voter bases. But essentially, the result has been a climate change bill that's likely to get through Parliament. So that's one example of a more consultative political process. Still a bit on the nasty side, but the last election results show that there's not a great deal of support for either of the major political parties. And here at New Politics, we do receive a lot of emails and suggestions about our podcast, and not too much of it is very positive, but we did receive some constructive commentary from one of our subscribers, John West, and he commented that there's one third of the electorate that didn't vote for the major political parties. And he also mentioned that he's generally distrustful of either the Labor Party or the Liberal National Coalition. And with the litany of corruption in New South Wales and Victoria politics, and previously in the federal politics too, well, who can blame him for that? He's sick of it, and he feels that if there was more cooperation between Labor and the Australian Greens and with the crossbenchers, that this would provide for a more positive outcome for the Australian community.
Look, it's hard not to agree. You want each party to have its individual core beliefs that it sticks to. But a lot of the arguing and fighting seems to be over semantics, seems to be over political point scoring rather than, I guess you'd call it, philosophical point scoring. The idea that you're arguing over little details that don't matter. Now, I'm sure if we had the major players in here, they'd say, no, these ideas do matter, because if you give away on these stuff, it becomes easier to give away on the key stuff. And I get that. But I'm wondering if the party system is starting to become anachronistic, given it was set up in the 18th and 19th century, lasted through the 20th century, okay, but we're now in the 21st century. It may be that our parties aren't modernizing quickly enough. Liberal Party came out with some very good analysis as to why they lost the election. They were still pinning a lot of the blame on Scott Morrison, but there was the notion that party membership is too old and that its message was going out to not enough voters across the age spectrum. The Greens attract such a broad range of people. They've been winning very safe seats. They've been campaigning well. They've been doing good messages, and they have a broad philosophy that seems to be in favour of most of the electorate. The Greens' issue is that if they're seen to be small and parochial and tiny, they won't get the same type of run that they're almost opposites, the Nationals. They do electorally very well, particularly given their size and their target aim. They are speaking to a smaller and smaller group of people, and we've found in National seats that if a viable option comes up, the National member tends to lose. Again, I don't know if this is just problems with each individual party that have all sort of appeared and have probably always been there, but with a broader media base, with independent media and a much more cynical electorate, if all the parties are suffering these all at once, or if there's a systemic issue, that it's a system that has run its course and we need to rethink how we do Parliament.
Oh, well, I think generally the two-party preferred voting process, it can actually mask some electoral problems for either political party. And this is not a complaint so much about the two-party preferred system. I think that it's actually a good and fair system, and both sides of politics have benefited from the system in the past. But the get a low primary vote and win through preferences strategy, I think that worked for Labor in 2022, and it could work again in the 2025 election. But election victories of this nature, I think, are quite difficult to navigate. And what I am suggesting is that an election victory based on a low primary vote, which is what happened for the Labor Party in 2022, that means that a government has to be more responsive to the needs and the desires of the electorate. And if the election result suggests that the public wants a more constructive and less combative political environment, and one which produces constructive solutions to problems, I think that's what the government has to deliver on. And there's still a high level of goodwill towards this new government. They've only been in office for close to 3 months now. The latest essential polls show that there's a high level of support for the Albanese government, and a strong strong belief that the government is heading in the right direction, and all of this can change quite quickly, of course, but bad political habits can form quickly, and it's easy for governments to fall into the trap of behaving like their predecessors that they've always complained about, but it's just something that they'll have to avoid if they want to continue receiving the support of the electorate. And over the past couple of weeks, Parliament question time started off reasonably well, but by the end of the parliamentary fortnight, the Dorothy Dixer questions for the government backbenchers to government ministers, they were starting to sound more like the ridiculous questions that we used to hear from the Morrison government. And maybe there's not enough people that listen into question time, and maybe this isn't such a big vote-changing issue, but Labor did say that when they were in opposition that they wanted to change Parliament and question time as well, but so far it just looks like a bit of window dressing. It is different, but not by much.
The other issue too is that you fight the last battle. This is what happens to the Liberal Party. They tried to run the exact same campaign in 2022 that they'd run in 2019 with fear and not fully comprehending that the electorate had smartened up or wised up to that, and that that approach wasn't going to work. Now, Labor getting in and suggesting that they were going to get rid of Dorothy Dixers. And then not really. Now, a Dorothy Dixer can be a useful thing if none of the opposition are asking you about a key piece of policy that you want to present to the House. Having someone safe get up and ask you the question can be a way of clarifying things in front of the House. It's when they take away from the opposition asking valid questions and can be used to give a much better view of things than perhaps is the case, that they are a problem. They should be used occasionally when necessary, but not all the time. And as Labor gets more entrenched, probably won't happen this term, but if they win the next election, you may find that the Dorothy Dixer becomes a more prominent part, particularly if the Liberal Party reinvigorates and brings in candidates much closer to the electorate, brings in candidates who are likely to appeal to swinging Labor seats. A good government should be able to win because they're good. Now, life doesn't always go that way, of course. Good governments have lost elections and bad governments have won elections. We've seen that within the last 10 years. But again, it's really important that the practice of good government is maintained.
Most of the analysis relating to the high number of crossbenchers has focused on the fact that most of the seats taken by independents and the Greens came off the Liberal Party. Not all of them, but most of them. And that the Liberal Party is the one that needs to learn from its mistakes if they ever want to get those seats back. But it's easy to fall into that trap of thinking that the teal independents will only affect the Liberal Party in the future. But the Labor Party also has to be wary of independents in future elections. So you do get a teal colour if you mix the Greens and the blue from the Liberal Party. Not sure what you get if you mix Greens politics with red Labor or a mixture of all the colours. Maybe we could call them the...
kind of a brown.
Yeah, well, maybe we could call them the puce independents if it gets to that stage. But the voices of movement, the teal independents, the Climate 200, whatever you want to call them, they'll be ambitious for more seats in future elections, as will the Greens after their successes at the 2022 election. So just because Labor won the election and now have government in their own right, we do have to remember that they're only three seats away from moving into a minority position. And it's hard to see the Liberal National Coalition getting enough traction over the next 3 years to pick up the 18 seats that they would need to form government at the next election. But for me, it is easier to imagine Labor losing a few seats to Greens or Independents. So I think the Labor Party does need to take these considerations into account over the next 3 years.
Politics is never easy. And running a national party and running a department, running a seat, running a caucus, none of those are easy by themselves, and yet that's what all of the cabinet has to do to a greater or lesser extent. It's going to be a challenge, as I think it's fair to say that in its current form, the Liberal Party is dead. I don't think it's terribly controversial to say that in its current form, the Liberal Party won't be elected again. It has the wrong leadership, the wrong philosophies, the wrong approach to everything. As it stands of now, things can change very quickly. We've seen this.
Oh, well, of course, things can change very quickly for a government and for an opposition. But the next few months will be critical for the federal government. There's a jobs and skills summit in early September, and already the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, has refused to accept an invitation to attend this summit. And he's suggested that it's just another stunt and another way of unions getting a greater piece of the action. And maybe Peter Dutton hasn't received the memo, but the Labor Party was formed from the union movement, and you'd expect unions to have more of a say when Labor is in government, but it's Peter Dutton's choice to attend or not to attend. There's also a budget in October, and it's not a budget update, it's an actual budget. So this will be quite a major event for the new Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. So a lot has happened since Labor returned to government in May, but there's also a lot that's going to happen over the next few months. And every month is critical for a government, but this is probably the most critical time for this government's agenda over the next 3 years. And it's mainly going to be a focus on jobs and the economy.
The Labor Party is clearly taking things seriously. I know that we get staffers and even some members listening to us, so I don't want to come across as too hard or too pessimistic. I'm just looking at potentialities down the track. And I think it is also fair to say that there's a very good cabinet, which we haven't had for 9 years. There's been a few decent-ish okay people who kind of were all right but weren't very good really over the last 9 years. Most of them should not have been anywhere near Parliament. Now we have people who are actually pretty fit and pretty worthwhile in government, which is a good thing. There's going to be mistakes, there's going to be disappointments, there's going to be mess-ups, there's going to be scandals. That's just the nature of things. The other thing too that we haven't really come across is that we have a flailing mainstream media who is also reaching the end of its time. Whether we'll be reading things like the Daily Telegraph in 10 years is really up in the air. I'm not so much of a clairvoyant that I can say that this will definitely happen, but this was the first election in a long time in which we went against Rupert Murdoch's and Kerry Stokes's and Fairfax's ideas. So we're seeing all kinds of changes that I don't think we've seen the end of yet and aren't really quite sure as to how they will play out yet, but it's good to be watching.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Amazon Music, Spotify, YouTube and SoundCloud, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can also support New Politics through Patreon.
Say goodbye, my one true lover, and we'll steal a lover's song. How it breaks my heart to leave you. Now look on, little has gone. Oh my love, the dawn is breaking, and my tears are falling rain. For the carnival is over, we may
And this issue almost came in at the last minute last week, but the Coalition's response to climate change is the same one that they simply cannot get rid of, and that's nuclear energy. Whenever they're in government, they commission reports and do nothing. Whenever they're in opposition, they demand nuclear energy as a solution to all of our energy problems. And we've reported on this in the past on New Politics, and the time for nuclear power in Australia was in the 1960s, and that time has passed. It's uneconomic. There isn't a clear case for it, as many federal government reports have indicated over the past 60 years. If the Coalition did have courage in their convictions, they would have installed nuclear power years ago and installed a nuclear power station in each of their electorates. They've been in office for 51 of the past 73 years, and they've never seriously pushed for it because they know that it's an uneconomic industry in Australia. But in 2022, it's used as empty political rhetoric and causing political trouble for the Labor Party.
When Margaret Thatcher was presented with the numbers of climate change, when she was presented with the evidence, she understood very quickly that climate change was, one, anthropogenic, two, it was a serious issue that needed to be dealt with, three, that the numbers were accurate or maybe a little bit under what they were for, and four, that something needed to be done. Now, Thatcher had trained in science, so she could understand these numbers to a certain extent. I think she was a chemist, not an environmental science, but she understood the science enough that it meant enough to her. Her first suggestion was Britain to go nuclear. And you're right, it's this default position. And of course, the thing with nuclear is that it can be monitored, it can be given a rate, it can be charged. Much harder to do with sunlight and wind, which aren't produced in any kind of way, don't need to be mined, and you don't need to have terribly that much equipment. It can all be done from the home. Solar panels on your roof, and you can click them into the main grid so that they can be used collectively, but it's hard to charge people to give stuff away. So the Liberal Party are trying to protect their donors and give their donors an out when coal and oil and gas are no longer a viable business. Thing is, again, you're right, nuclear power is not a viable business, and it's a much more dangerous business than coal, oil, or gas.
Oh, well, for me, it's just a boring and very predictable debate, but this debate about nuclear energy, it's almost become as frequent as the debate about a super fast train from Melbourne to Sydney or Sydney to Brisbane or virtually any other city in Australia. It's usually brought up around election time, but it's never going to happen, and we all pretty much know that. Now, I'd dearly love to see very fast train links in Australia, but it's uneconomic, and the airline industry has got too much political clout for it to ever happen. But the main reason Peter Dutton decided to bring up nuclear energy was that he'd been thoroughly outplayed politically on the climate change bill and had nothing to offer. So he decided to bring this to the table. It's a divisive issue. The Coalition commissioned a report into nuclear energy as recently as 2019. That report was tabled by the Energy Minister at the time, Angus Taylor, in December 2019. So that's less than 2 years ago. The report collected a lot of dust, and the committee that was responsible for that report has been dissolved. So the Liberal Party is so serious about nuclear energy that it's virtually thrown away a report that they commissioned into nuclear energy and then did nothing about it. But now that they're in opposition, they demand that the government needs to seriously adopt nuclear energy as a climate change mitigation measure. It sounds like a bit of political grandstanding without actually offering any meaningful solutions.
It makes them sound like they're doing something. It appeals to that more conservative wing of people who think that nuclear power is a good idea. It doesn't commit them to anything Labor has suggested or Greens have suggested, and it gets them in the paper, which I think is the main point. Whether that's an effective strategy over the next 10 years to use the mainstream media like that remains to be seen. I'm not confident of its effectiveness.
Well, a lot of our critics are suggesting, well, nuclear energy is used in quite a few other countries and it takes up 10% of the world's energy usage as well, and that's actually true. France is almost entirely powered by nuclear energy, but there has been a push to decommission nuclear power stations since the Fukushima disaster in Japan in 2011, and also over the past 10 to 15 years, there's been increased efficiencies and reliability of renewable energies. But I think that the idea of nuclear energy in Australia is just this lazy conservative response to climate change, as you alluded to before, David. And there's been so many reports into the nuclear energy over the past 60 years, and all of them have concluded that the industry is unviable in Australia and can't compete with all of those traditional energy sources such as coal, which is now being shown to be uncompetitive with renewable energy. So the obvious solution is renewable energy, as far as I can see. The other nuclear solution promoted by conservatives is small modular reactors, and I thought that we should have a go at this as well today. Now, there's just not enough evidence to completely dismiss small modular reactors, but there's only one existing unit in Russia. There's a few more experimental sites that are in the pipeline, but they are relatively small, which means that you need many of them to be efficient. But this means that small modular reactors spread out over more sites within a country could make them susceptible to terrorist attacks or acts of war. And there was that recent Russian attack on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, so it's not something that's completely out of the question. And of course, you do have to consider all options if you are trying to address climate change. But nuclear doesn't seem to be the answer in Australia, and 60 years of reports confirm that as well. Yet the Liberal and National parties keep pushing it.
Again, follow the money. And the other thing too is that, which we've alluded to, that it makes them sound like they've got a practical solution, which no one in Australia is ever going to take up because it's just not financially viable. At the moment, the Liberal Party are floundering and looking for direction and looking for any hook they can get in to become relevant again. That's understandable given what's happened. That's the way it is.
Oh, well, the Liberal and National parties, they are out of office now. They're becoming irrelevant, or more and more irrelevant as far as I can see. And all the opposition is prepared to do is recycle some old ideas, which were never good ideas in the first place anyway. They're also very happy to use Tony Abbott's playbook of opposition behaviour. Throw political bombs, offer no solutions, create havoc for the government, and display all that awfulness that they displayed when they were in office. And as Tony Abbott showed, if your reason for existence is just to get back into government, then this is a really effective tactic. But you do need political skill to do this. And, you know, I'm not suggesting this is a good thing to do, but it's a very destructive process to go through, as we've seen over the past 10 years. Tony Abbott managed to get the Liberal and National Coalition back into office, but the past 10 years have been absolutely abysmal. But even still, I don't think that Peter Dutton has got the skill to go through this sort of process. And this is the old spoiler approach to opposition politics, just at a time when the electorate is looking for something different. But for the coalition, nothing is positive, everything is negative, everything is bad news, and this type of approach destroys the soul. And already they've refused to participate in the Jobs and Skills Summit, and this week they were also discrediting Anthony Albanese for taking a 1 week break, and their rationale is that Albanese played politics when Scott Morrison went on holidays. Well, no, he actually didn't. He was supportive of Scott Morrison going on holidays during the time that he was Prime Minister. He just questioned the timing and the secrecy of the Hawaii trip that he made at a time when half of Australia was burning during the 2019 bushfire season. And if I was a coalition, I would just shut up about Morrison's trip to Hawaii in 2019. You don't need to keep reminding the public about it. It's best to keep quiet about that and leave it all behind. Just get on with being a decent opposition. It's what the public is expecting of them.
Yes, oppositions oppose. Good oppositions oppose with purpose, and they oppose with alternatives. Really, when you're in opposition, you're saying, this is why we should be the government. And that was always my problem with Tony Abbott's style of opposition. He never really sold it to me that it would be good government. And turns out that those of us who noticed that were right. It was a terrible government, which was then succeeded by two governments that were just as bad or worse. Labor is in a very good position at the moment. And if it can hold its nerve, not get too crazy about things, and make sure that it keeps its focus as a Labor Party. And again, a Labor Party of the 21st century, not trying to recreate the Hawke, Whitlam, Chifley years, Curtin years, but actually as a modern Labor Party. And the Liberal Party should be trying to be a modern Liberal Party of the 21st century. And that's where they may find they start to become more successful. We're still on a very quickly deposed and debunked model from 15 years ago, which really was a 1996 model, which really was a model that had struggled to get through from 1905 or so. And this takes us back to that original point I was making, that I'm not sure that the party system as it stands at the moment is really going to last much longer without at least significant reform.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Amazon Music, Spotify, YouTube and SoundCloud, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can also support New Politics through Patreon.
Like the legend of the Phoenix, all ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.
And there have been some more revelations about the New York Trade Commissioner job that was offered to the former National Party leader, John Barilaro. And you know that when you've got a state issue blowing up into a national issue, you've got real problems happening there. This is a gift that keeps on giving to the New South Wales Labor Party. Already, the Minister for Trade, Stuart Ayres, he's resigned, and officially it's because it wasn't clear if he complied with the New South Wales Ministerial Code of Conduct. But essentially, it's because it appears that he misled Parliament and the public, and it seems that he tried to contrive a situation where a political mate was being installed into a lucrative overseas posting in New York. The final stages of the New South Wales Labor government up until 2011 had a similar stench to it, and that was thrown out of office with an electoral humiliation at that 2011 New South Wales election. But it seems that this New South Wales coalition government is heading for a similar result. Ministers resigning and being sacked, corrupt behaviour that they're hoping to get away with. This is becoming an unstable government, and with the Premier under pressure and an election due in March 2023, it's not looking very good for the New South Wales Liberal and National parties.
For a political analyst, it's been both hugely upsetting and highly fun. John Barilaro is one of the lesser figures, shall we say, of the New South Wales National Party, a party that hasn't presented a lot of people of substance to the world, shall we say. But like a lot of New South Wales politics, it's been a parade of mediocrities with delusions of adequacy. I think that's throughout all parties. We can point to figures here and there and say, but mostly, New South Wales hasn't had the most stellar politicians at a state level, shall we say. And our worst premiers have been Mike Baird, Gladys Berejiklian and Dominic Perrottet in almost that order. There are plenty of Labor premiers who rank down there as well, but certainly the Perrottet premiership, disastrous, springs to mind. Barilaro, and you can't say this enough, but Barilaro was the leader of the coalition party who didn't understand that if you left the coalition, you lost your cabinet positions. He thought he could leave the coalition, not vote in with the government, but keep all the ministries, and was told in no uncertain terms by, of all people, Gladys Berejiklian, that that was not the case. If you left, fine, but you lost the jobs too. How you get to run a Westminster-style party in a modern yet fairly established parliament and not know this? And every day, just about, something new comes out about this trade position that hurts everyone involved.
Oh, but I think that being unaware of all of those political protocols and parliamentary protocols, well, that's one issue. But the New South Wales government is now a government that is totally unaware of its own corruption. Yeah. And just can't seem to understand what the problem is when they're caught out. And this is what happened with former Premier Gladys Berejiklian when she resigned last year, not being able to understand that her actions were, on the surface, corrupt. And we won't find out whether it was corrupt or not until the New South Wales ICAC releases its report. But there's other information that's coming out about all of these issues at the moment. And the Transport Minister, David Elliott, he was reportedly offered the London Trade Commissioner position as an inducement to leave politics. And you're left wondering, well, if these are the types of people that they're planning to put into these positions, well, maybe the positions are not that important. But New South Wales politics always seems to attract the worst people. And, you know, I've got to point out that there is some very, very good people that have existed in New South Wales politics and are currently there at the moment. But there's just something about the political culture in New South Wales. And this goes for all sides of politics, Labor, Liberal, National, the Greens, One Nation. There's no shortage of people that are only too happy to get onto that gravy train. And John Barilaro is now claiming that he's the victim in all of this, suggesting that it's ridiculous to suggest that he changed the position from a public service appointment to a ministerial appointment just to benefit himself, even though he did actually seem to benefit himself and actually ended up being appointed to the position of the New York Trade Commissioner. But I think the most unbelievable part of all of this is that these are adult people in public life that seem to think that this is all very believable and we should just accept that they're telling us the truth about this. And I think that's probably the worst part of it.
He's due to appear again in front of the commission. He came out with a lot of stuff that the documentary evidence didn't seem to support. Of course, that may have just been his understanding of things. I'm not accusing him of anything yet. He's highly litigious as well.
So we better be careful about what we say here.
I'm not casting aspersions on his testimony, which was, again, to be fair, under oath. But it did seem to be at odds with what had already been reported, whether that's because what had been reported hadn't been the full story, whether it's because he wasn't aware of a lot of what had been reported. He denied a couple of things. He claimed he never said he was wanting to get out of New South Wales. Having said all that, he hasn't impressed anyone for his suitability to the job, for example. The best reference that Stuart Ayres, the minister in charge, could come up with was he could be quite good, which is hardly a ringing endorsement, is it? There did seem to be a lack of enthusiasm, except from the Premier, who denies knowing anything about it. And so John Barilaro, whose achievements don't seem to have stacked up to very much, apart from being leader of the National Party, and it has transpired that the employment documents were edited after to make him look better. Now, all this is, again, alleged. I'm just going on what the newspapers say, so if you're going to sue us, sue those people with symptoms, not the disease.
Oh, well, we've got a few lawyers that can act pro bono for us, so I don't think there's going to be any problems there.
That's good to know.
But we talked about this before, that the New South Wales Labor government behaved like a corrupt government in the final few years of office up until 2011, and they had several ministers who were found to be corrupt in a court of law. And that was Eddie Obeid and Ian MacDonald. And we've had a pretty rotten and corrupt New South Wales Liberal National Government over the past few years. But all the fun and games are not just happening in New South Wales. Victoria has had its fair share of corruption issues as well, with a series of branch stacking issues referred to the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission. And they found that there were several Labor MPs that were engaged in extensive misconduct and corruption. Now, you would think that if there are issues of misconduct and corruption surrounding the government of the day, best not to interrupt them and let them soak up all of the problems. But there's been revelations that the Chief of Staff to Opposition Leader, Matthew Guy, was asking Liberal Party donors to transfer $100,000 into his private business account. And there's no prizes for guessing how this money was going to be used, Liberal Party campaigning. And it was done in this way so it could circumvent political donation and funding rules. Now, Matthew Guy is claiming that because his Chief of Staff didn't actually carry through with the deal, that it's all okay, nothing to see here. But in criminal law, there is an offence known as conspiracy to commit a crime. And this event has now been referred to the Victoria IBAC. Matthew Guy has lost three staff members because of allegedly corrupt behaviour within the past week. And now there's rumours swirling of a challenge to Matthew Guy's leadership. And this is all happening with the Victoria state election due in November, just a few months away. All of this trouble could have been avoided if these people in New South Wales and Victoria just behaved themselves and stopped acting corruptly. But it just seems like it's too much to ask for within state politics.
State politics, of course, is probably the most open to corruption, in that a lot of our laws are enforced at a state level. A lot of town development and town expansion is done at a state level, and transport is done at a... So it's probably the one most open to corruption of the three levels, although there's the potential for all three levels of government to have corruption, of course. I don't want to say that any level of government is beyond reproach. New South Wales has been particularly bad. I did find a long period of time where there was no corruption, and that was the period leading up to 1788. After then, things go downhill pretty quickly. Again, it's so entrenched that, and you mentioned this before, that they don't know that it's corrupt. And we can take this back to Nick Greiner giving Terry Metherill the head of the EPA position in 1991. Yeah, he just didn't understand. Gladys Berejiklian basically made the argument saying that I would never do anything corrupt. Hence, I have never done anything corrupt, without really understanding that those phone taps demonstrated that everything she did was corrupt. And she probably didn't realize just how corrupt it was, or had an inkling. She does say at one point, very famously, "You don't need to tell me about that." So she knew that there was something dodgy going on. Mike Baird steps down all of a sudden. We can look at Bob Carr stepping down all of a sudden. And of course, in New South Wales, the assumption is that sometimes you step down because you are sick of it and you'll want to spend more time with your family. But in New South Wales, it's more likely that something's going to go down that might get you into a lot of trouble if you're found with your hands around it. Victoria has had corruption too, but it hasn't been as blatant as New South Wales's was. The Matthew Guy corruption is almost farcical. Pay the $100,000 into my account. The hubris and the arrogance that they think that they can get away with being so blatantly open about it, I think says a lot to the system. The race is now on who will be the first Liberal leader to be replaced. Will it be Dominic Perrottet in New South Wales, who may have received a bit of a reprieve by sacking his deputy? There are those who have pointed out to me that how is it that Stuart Ayres gets sacked, yet a man responsible for thousands of deaths in Brad Hazard and who has bullied his staff openly in public, again, Brad Hazard, keeps his job. So Perrottet may have kept his position for a few more weeks, but will Matthew Guy last? He already had lost the job and somehow got it back. The next Victorian election is November. It doesn't look like the figure of Dan Andrews is going anywhere very soon. They keep accusing him of stuff and he keeps finding that he's not guilty of it. So unless the conspiracy theorists are 100% right, I'm guessing Dan Andrews will be retained with even an increased majority or maybe a slight decline. I think he's lost a little bit of skin over the last few months, but he can afford to lose the skin given the mess that the Victorian Liberals are in.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.